And as it's just the top of the hour, I'd like to introduce our host for today, Wei Yu, who is a health economist at the VA Health Econometrics Resource Center, acronym HERC. Wei, can I turn things over to you?
Yes. Thanks, Rob. Let me give an introduction of today's speaker, Dr. Kieran Phipps. Kieran is really a senior person at HERC and also at VA, I think about more than 30 years. Currently, Dr. Phipps is the Associate Director at the Health Economics Resource Center. And he is also health economist at the Center for Innovation to Implementation and the Cooperative Studies Program Coordinating Center at the VA Palo Alto. Now, he is also the Associate Director of the Women's Health Evaluation Initiative and the Associate Director of the Geriatrics and Extended Care Data and Analysis Center. He has many titles. He's also an Associate Professor Research in the Department of Pediatrics at the Stanford University School of Medicine. His own VA research project have focused on the demand for VA healthcare and how travel distance and the availability of non-VA alternative influence veterans' use of VA care, and how nurse staffing affects patient outcomes. He also doing something else, you know, given there are so many different roles, but I think he is a really senior person, understand a lot of the issues in the VA study, so we're very happy to have Kieran give today's talk. Kieran, it's your time.
Okay, thank you, Wei. Just checking that the title slide is showing up on people's slides.
Yes, sir. It looks good, and okay. You sound great.
Okay, so the idea behind this is that lots of times when people talk about regression, there's lots of thought. Okay, I have a 0-1 dependent variable. I need regression. Some of these other courses we'll talk about in the HERC course, we'll talk about, oh, cost is a dependent variable. How do I handle that? Or concerns about causation in terms of instrumental variables, all these other things. And a lot of times, and I've seen this many times reviewing manuscripts, people really don't give enough thought to the variables in the right-hand side or their independent variables. And the reason this is important is regression models make a lot of assumptions about these independent variables. And, you know, just even thinking back when I was taking econometrics in graduate school, they really don't get enough attention in terms of some of these assumptions and some of the things you need to do to really make a regression model work as it should. And so the purpose of this talk is to selectively identify some of these problems and methods of addressing them. And some of these things are things that actually a standard econometrics or regression analysis class will not cover, and it's sort of things people need to learn from a mentor or pick up on their own. And the topics that I'm going to talk about are heteroscedasticity, clustering of observations, data aggregation, functional form, and testing for multicollinearity. And just to remind people, I've instructed Wei that if there are relevant questions to interrupt me, otherwise we will defer questions to the end. So most of you probably have encountered the concept of heteroscedasticity. Regression assumes what are called homoscedastic errors, which assumes that the error terms are independent of the Xi or your right-hand side variables. But there are some patterns that don't follow that. A very common one is as your X's get bigger, the error terms get bigger. For example, if you know in a classic economic thing where you're, say, estimating you know, how much a person buys, and one of the variables in the X is their amount of their income. As that gets bigger, the variance in how much they consume gets bigger. So your EIs are going to get bigger. That's just sort of a very classic case of heteroscedasticity. And with heteroscedasticity, what you're doing is you're biasing your standard errors. The parameter estimates are still unbiased, but they are somewhat inefficient. And yes, I am an economist, so there's a very simple solution in Stata. For every regression there in Stata, there's a robust option which will give you the Huber-White standard errors, which will correct the standard errors and make this problem go away. And so you can get the correct standard errors. The other thing to think about in terms of heteroscedasticity is transforming the variables. So using log of x instead of x would be a solution that might correct some of the problem that I described in that example of income on consumption spending. And, you know, you just have to look at the nature of your variables and the nature of the error structure and understand it. And so, in other words, look at your regression diagnostics carefully and may think about what's in your model and possibly make adjustments. The heteroscedasticity is one that's pretty simple in terms of what we're going to talk about. Clustering is a problem that more people are addressing, but not everybody thinks about. And again, the standard regression model shown here assumes that the error terms are uncorrelated. In many healthcare applications, we have observations that are clustered or nested, if you will. It's a common problem. For example, patients can be clustered within hospitals. And so they're not totally in. And we have lots of other, because, you know, you look at a big data set and the same, many patients will see a single physician. So you have patients clustered within physicians, et cetera. And so this clustering is something that comes up all of the time. And in this model, if I'm only estimating patient variables in X, it doesn't cause a problem. Where it causes a problem is, and I'm going to use just as an example, a regression where I have patient level and hospital level variables, but it could be any other thing where we have, you know, patients clustered within hospitals, you know, sort of individuals clustered within other things. I mean, you, in terms of clustering, if you have repeated observations of an individual, that's a type of clustering too. So here we have our independent variables. This is individual I, the outcome we're interested in, and we have a vector of patient-level variables, and then we may have one or more hospital-level variables. And if the model specified this way, regression assumes that for each, because we're assuming independence of each observation, we are assuming in this model right here as specified that there are as many hospitals as there are patients. And that is obviously not the case. And if you may remember from your basic regression class that as you increase your sample sizes, your standard errors will get smaller because the regression seems to be more precise. And so the problem here is that for these hospital level variables, that the standard errors are too small because there are actually many fewer observations than the regression thinks they are, so it's shrinking those standard errors. And but the parameter estimates are totally unbiased. There's essentially no effect on the parameter estimate. There are various ways of doing this, I'm just going to talk about these first, and then I'm going to actually show you why this can matter. Generalized estimating equations or other hierarchical methods can be used. And again, in Stata, there's a very easy option that's called the cluster option, which works within essentially every regression command in Stata. And what you do is you just, where you put your regression options, you put cluster equals. In this case, I would put the hospital ID in there, and that'll apply a correction of the standard errors so that it undoes that artificial shrinking of the standard error and gives you a corrected standard error. GEE and the Stata cluster option give you essentially the same result. Edward Norton I don't know if he ever actually published it, but he shared a working paper with me where he went through and compared them, and he actually dived into the math, and the difference was someplace in the formula, one place is dividing by n minus 1, and in another formula, they're dividing by n. So it's like a trivial difference. In terms of, you know, using GEE or Stata cluster option, you're getting the same option. You can get slightly different answers if you're interested in modeling the formal hierarchical structure, which I am not going to address in detail in this lecture because that's sort of another whole realm of models about how to estimate hierarchical models, sort of beyond the scope of this lecture, but something to be considered. Hierarchical models, because they're informally incorporating this structure, essentially you're estimating more than one model, and they can be used for nonlinear models also. So I'm going to leave that. The one final note I will make about hierarchical linear model versus these other methods is it really depends on the data structure and the relationships. And often you actually get very similar answers. Sometimes you don't, because it depends on the structure of the data and also the the power of the facility, the effects of the different structures. I'm going to talk just to show you that this actually can matter in real life. This is a paper from a old project I had. Wei mentioned my pediatric appointment, and I have a robust research agenda there. And I apologize for not using a VA example, but this is a good example, and I've carefully addressed it. So where I was looking at the effects of NICU patient volume and the level of care on mortality. In NICU's care is formally regionalized, and higher level centers are more able to care for patients, and I was interested in trying to tease apart the effects of those levels and those volumes. In this example, what I really want to show is the extent of the correction is going to vary with the size of the sample and the number of clusters relative to the number of observations. With big effects, big samples, these correction effects will be pretty small. And in the example I'm talking about, I had almost 50,000 observations in over 200 hospitals. So there was a lot of data, and the effects tended to be relatively small. And just to show you, the one that I want to highlight, if you look here, just to orient you, the labels are really sort of unimportant. The parameter estimates will not change with the methods. It's, comparing the corrected confidence interval with the unadjusted or not correcting for clustering confidence interval. And you see in this first row that those changes are relatively minor. And this bottom row here was the sample with lots and lots of observations, and the effect is minor. That applied here also. But this one that's in a different color here, the statistical significant changes. And what's of note here is this was a, even though I had this big sample, this was a sample that depending on the year had between 2 and 4 hospitals. So it was a very sort of very small and unique group. And because of that, the effects of the clustering were much larger and the was no longer statistically significant. And that just goes back to my point that this is going to be more important if you have smaller samples. And it's, or in this case, in a very big sample, but I had a particular cell or cluster that was small, and therefore the effect on the standard error was bigger. So even if you, oh, I have a real big sample, I don't really have to worry about this. Well, you, if you have small cells, then you, it still can be a problem, and you can get incorrect results. So again, you just need to think about your data structure. If you have, think carefully, do you have cluster observations, and then use one of the methods to correct for them. And one of the things you might do is use more than one method to correct for them. Data aggregation is something that is becoming increasingly apparent can be problematic. And what I mean by the data aggregation is that many times we have a choice about how to organize our data. You know, do we take all, you know, do we get annual data? Do we get monthly data? Do we get weekly data? Do we get data for the whole hospital? Do we get data for each clinic or unit? And, you know, I'm just throwing out some examples here. There's lots of things where frequently we aggregate together data from groups that may or may not, you know, be similar, and this can affect the results. In general, as you increase aggregation, you're going to reduce your variance. I mean, just to use an example, if I'm looking at, and this is going to lead into the example I'm going to talk about, if you look at the number of patients in a unit on a hospital, there's going to be variance. And there'll be more variant, you know, variance in particular units than there will be in the overall aggregate hospital census, because there's going to be data, more data, you know, more day-to-day fluctuation than, and so if you look at just the unit census versus the hospital census, you're going to, it'll affect your variance. And the other thing to remember is that the aggregation can change the relationship between the variable of interest and the dependent variable. And I'll talk about that because, you know, you may be masking things. And the data that I'm going to use is from a paper we published a few years ago in the American Economic Journal on nurse staffing. We are explicitly looking at the effects of how long nurses have been working on the unit, so their experience on the unit or their unit tenure, on patient outcomes. And we were running patient-level regressions, and just to show this point, I ran some, we ran our data at the unit month level because that's the smallest level that we could get all the data, smallest common denominator that we could pull data together. But just for exposition purposes, I ran it using annual data and also compared using the unit versus using the whole hospital, just as an example of this. This is not in the paper. This was sort of a point. And so to lead you through these results, the first column of results here is when I aggregate all the units and patients to the whole hospital. Here is when I look at acute care units and ICU separately, and these are with monthly data. This first row is the number of nurses per patient day, and you see as we were using length of stay as an all-cause indicator of bad things happening. As you increase your length of, you increase your nurse staffing, the risk-adjusted length of stay went down. And what is interesting here is this was a 0.01 effect, but if I break this apart in the acute care units, the effect was much larger, and the effect was smaller in the ICUs. But interestingly, both of these independent effects were bigger than the effect that we got when we aggregated everything together. And it goes beyond that. Here, if I look at the percentage of the staff that were licensed practical nurses, in aggregate, more LPNs is associated with better outcome. But if I break it apart, not only are neither of them significant, but this one for ICUs, it actually has the opposite sign. And then this is for unlicensed personnel. We get a similar pattern where the effect is, here's the effect is big. I break it apart. It's smaller. It's big, but not significant. And this is for worse outcomes. And here we get worse outcomes universally for contract, if you're using contract nurses instead of nurses that regularly work in the unit. But again, the masking effect, that these effects here are bigger in the independent units than they are in the combined units. Again, what's happening is there's a lot of variance and stuff going on, plus acute care units and ICU units are fundamentally different units, and there's different relationships, and putting them together can cause some sort of these bizarre patterns. And when I'm not going to show them here, but we get even more bouncing around of the results when we look at results at the annual level versus just the monthly level. The point being is think about your data and don't aggregate data that shouldn't be aggregated. And this is a case where ICU patients are very different than acute care patients. They're much sicker. They have much higher nurse levels of baseline nurse staffing, et cetera. And so you get different relationships. And this is something that you find a lot in the data. So as you're designing your study, think about what level of aggregation should I use? And, you know, with the obvious constraint that, you know, what data do I have? The next thing that I want to talk about is functional form. In the classic regression model here, beta x is assuming that each variable in x has a linear relationship with y, or our variable of outcome. This is not always in the case, and this can result in misspecified models. As a rule of thumb, you should check the functional form for every non-binary variable in your model. Well, there are some formal tests for functional specification, and some of you may have seen some of these in various classes, but these tests just tell you, oh, your model's not specified right, and they really don't provide a whole lot of guidance of, okay, what should I do? And so I'm going to go through an example of using dummy variables to examine functional form. And what this does is it gives you an understanding of what the true functional form is. And so what I will do, and just think of, you know, I want to think of hypothetically, I want to control for age in my regression model. Well, look at the distribution of your data and say, you know, what kind of groupings could I make? If you have a big sample, you could, you know, have a dummy for each year of age. You might, you know, with smaller samples, you might have to combine them. But make a set of dummies with reasonably small intervals and no excluded categories, and then run a regression, run a model with no intercept term. And what you're doing here is, because this set of dummy variables, it's a non-parametric specification, and you're getting a point estimate for each of these things, you're sort of plotting out what the distribution looks like. And this will let you look at it and say, oh, okay, what should I do for my functional form? And you can look at it and, oh, okay, that looks very linear. You don't have to make any change. Or you can look at it and say, oh, that isn't linear. Now you think about it, okay, is it a log? Do I need to break it into sets of dummies? There's lots of different possibilities. And so I'm going to just show you some plots from that same data set. We went through this exercise. And what the exercise is take all those dummy, you run the regression with those dummy variables and then graph out those parameter estimates for each dummy variable. And it will give you a good idea of what the functional form looks like, and you can use that to determine functional forms would be good starting points or where to make cuts for categorical variables. So in this case, in terms of the effect of volume on outcome with NICUs, we had a very steep drop and then it leveled off, and we ended up using a set of dummy variables you saw for a lot of reasons, one of which was ease of presentation, but you could say, okay, this has a log function or something, and you could see how that would fit as well. So you can try to fit continuous forms for some types of things, a transformation like a log or squaring or something or exponending will work because you have it has a continuous nonlinear form. But a lot of time in healthcare, you'll have an application where you'll have more like spline functions. Like if you look here, this looks almost linear, and this looks almost linear here. And so you need to be a little more variable. And this is just, again, showing you we actually we looked at the data for all different kinds of groups in terms of guiding this. And yes?
Yes. Could you go back to your slide? And then there's a question ask you, what is the axis on this graph?
Oh, okay.
The vertical, so the horizontal? Yeah.
I was trying to estimate the effect of volume on, and this was the point estimates for each of those volumes. So I was estimating the effect of volume on mortality, and these are the odds. So the vertical axis is the odds ratios for each point estimate for each group in the volume using very small intervals of volume. And that showed me, okay, so that's the effect of the marginal effect of volume. So here at very small volumes, there was much higher mortality, and when we get down to volumes of 150, there was no increased risk for mortality. And what does that function look like? And that's what you're doing. So you're graphing what is the marginal effect of the independent variable you're interested in on your outcome, and you're looking, so this will tell you then what you should do for a functional form. And just going beyond that, what I was referring to is that for some applications, instead of, if you go back here, you could say, okay, well, that might be some sort of a logarithmic function, or you could say it might be a linear here and then linear there, and I can do a spline trying to present continuous splines or something to a medical audience when this was the main variable of interest from a policy perspective. How big are the units and how does that affect outcome? Yes.
Excuse me, and I think people still have not familiar with how you got this. Yeah, how you got this graphic? It's a dependent variable equal to. Are you run the regression?
Yeah. So basically, what I did to lay this out is I ran my regression model where the dependent variable was mortality, and I had a bunch of patient characteristics, and this was a hospital characteristic for the number of patients that the hospital treated in a year. On, you know, so I was looking for a volume outcome relationship on mortality. And what I was concerned with is that that wasn't straight linear. And if you were to go from here to here as a straight line, you see that relationship is not linear. And so the question was how to specify the effect of patient volume on mortality. And okay. That's what I was trying to get at. And what I was also trying to get at here is how I should specify that. And in my particular example, that was complicated by the fact that I also had these different levels of NICU that were of different sizes. And, you know, the highest level NICUs were bigger than the smallest level NICUs, which were all smaller. And so this is why, in terms of that volume function, what I ended up doing in this paper was to use categorical variables, and these are the same things that I showed you before, where I'm combining the level of the NICU, how capacity they are, and how many infants they were treating into groups. And these cut points and how I defined these groups were defined by careful examination of these functions. And so I got then groups that were relatively, and the reference group was the really big hospitals that were treating more than 100. Because if you look back here at more than 100, it's basically a flat line for my reference group, whereas it's still going up here. And we tested this a lot carefully in terms of a lot of things. And this gave us a cognizant way to present these results for a lot of different groups that we could put on a simple table in a paper. Sorry for the confusion. You all, in any basic regression class, they talk about multicollinearity. And the issue is, how do you address it? And the issue is, if I have two variables, and I'm simplifying it here with just two variables, what if they're strongly correlated? And so the regression, especially if they're perfectly correlated, the regression blows up. They can't determine what's to attribute to X1 and what to attribute to X2. If they're not perfectly correlated, but they're strongly correlated, the regression is going to have trouble sorting out what do I attribute to X1 versus X2. And this is going to increase the standard errors, and it can also increase the parameter estimates. In extreme cases, and I've actually seen this with highly correlated variables in a regression model, where you get that, I'm just going to hypothetically lay out an example here. Let's say that the true effect of the two factors together was a positive 0.5, and you'll get one of them estimating a negative 1 and the other estimating a 2. And so they're jointly, if you add them together, you're getting that 0.5, but it's like crazy parameters. And that's an extreme case, doesn't happen very often. What you tend to get is one getting bigger and the other getting smaller, but you can do weird things to the parameters, and I'll show you some more examples of some more likely patterns about how putting two highly correlated factors affects your parameter estimates. And so the first thing is you need to check to see if you have correlation, collinearity problems in your data set. I mean, simple check you should always first run is to look at your data. Just look at the correlation coefficients between the parameters. If you have something that is highly correlated, you almost certainly have a problem. But things can be more subtle than that. There are regression diagnostics which will test for this. There's something called the variance inflation factor in SAS. It's the /VIF option. and you use the VIF is in the state of regression diagnostics. Measures the inflation of the variance of each parameter due to collinearities among the regressors. And so you get a number, and you'll get a number for one of the, you'll get this variance inflation number for each variable in your model. And as a general rule of thumb, if you have a VIF greater than 10, it implies that you have a significant collinearity problem. Some statistical problems, programs may present this in terms of the tolerance, which is just 1 over the variance inflation factor. But so either can be used to identify a variable, and this what that tells you is, okay, this variable has a collinearity problem, but it doesn't tell you anything about the collinearity structure of what it's correlated with and what that structure looks like. Simple rules of thumb for collinearity is if you have anything greater than 0.5, you're very likely to have a problem, but you can still have collinearity problems where the correlation coefficient between the two variables is less than 0.5. Okay, I'm going to work through an example here using this the data I talked about previously with nurse staffing and patient outcomes. And as I mentioned, one of the things we were interested in was looking at the effect of how long the nurse had been working on the unit and how that moderated the effect of nurse staffing, or did it have an effect. Just to let you know, we found that increased tenure on the unit was associated with better patient outcomes, not surprising for those that know nursing. But when we were looking at the nurse tenure on the unit and age, they were correlated, because the people that had been working on the unit longer, as you work on a unit longer, by definition, you get older. And the correlation was 0.46, which is below that, you know, 0.5 rule of thumb that basic econometrics classes talk about. Depending on the subset and the models, we were getting variance inflation factors on these variables in the range of 18 to 30. And to show you here, I'm going to show you how the So we knew we had some collinearity. Well, what are the problems? Well, if you get more observations, as long as there isn't perfect correlation, the additional variables will help the regression partition the share of the variance to associate with, or the associations to associate with one variable versus the other. So it helps. You can revise the data in ways that reduce the correlation. So in terms of transformations, and I'll cycle back to that in a minute. In this example, we ended up dropping age from the model. And I want to show you why we did this. If we run a model where we included tenure but not include age, we got a statistically significant parameter. If we only include age, we got a statistically significant parameter, but it was indicating that it was less important. If we included both, the parameters for both of them got smaller, and neither of them were significant. Our solution in this case was to just exclude age, but there are other things that one can do. Just as an example, in my neonatal work where you have birth weight and gestational age, you can play around by looking at deviations. So this is an example of strong simple correlation. One of the things that I want to impress upon people is that you can have a problem that won't be detected by these simple tests. And remember that regression is what n space, where n is the number of variables in the model. And essentially what regression is doing, if you conceive of it, is that there are, for the number of variables you have in your model, you have an n-dimensional space, and there's a bunch of n-space planes, and if you have correlation in any of those planes, and these correspond to the eigenvectors of a regression, for those of you that have more training, and there's an option in SAS called the colon option, which actually looks at how much of the variance in each eigenvector is explained by it, each variable. Intuitively, this is the correlation in the nth dimension of the regression. And I mentioned the newborn example before, where you have birth weight and gestational age are very correlated among small people. Especially among preterm infants. As the baby ages in gestation, they get bigger. And I'm just going to run a very simple model. I just ran a very simple model where I only included birth weight, gestational age, and African American. And this colon option, which again is just slash colon to invoke in proc reg, gives a condition index for each variable, and a condition index greater than 10 indicates a colinearity problem. A condition index greater than 100 indicates a strong problem. And there's a strong correlation if the variance proportion in the eigenvector of two or more variables have values of greater than 50%. So you look here, and what you're seeing is that first eigenvector this is just showing four eigenvectors in that output of that simple model that I kept it simple to make it tractable on the slide. The first one, that first eigenvector, is weighting heavily on black. The second is weighting heavily on birth weight. The third is weighting heavily on gestational age, but it's also weighting heavily on birth weight, and so we get this, we get a condition index more than 10, indicating that we have, you know, a colinearity problem between birth weight and gestational age, and it's showing up in this particular eigenvector. Just to show in terms of transforming the variables, what I did instead of using continuous variables for birth weight, and I did this actually because there's also a problem with the functional form because it has a nonlinear functional form, in terms of the functional form that I referred to earlier, and basically if you use any of the standard transformations, you get problems fitting in the, if you fit for one part of the distribution, it doesn't fit for the other. So I used very small intervals of birth weight, 100-gram intervals, and we used separate dummies for males, females, and singletons because they have different relationship, and dummy variables for birth weight, for gestational age. When we do this, the max conditional index dropped to less than 8, and the model predictions actually improved. And so this is an example of transforming the data in response to a correlation, and by breaking it into sets of dummies for both of them and allowing, because there was enough overlap across groups, we could break the colinearity problem and get a stable estimate.
Could you stop here? I think I see several questions in the collinearity.
Yeah.
You want to. I think okay. there are a couple questions related to the nurse staff example you showed earlier.
Yeah.
One question is, can you combine the two correlated variables into one using factor analysis?
That would be another possibility. Again, this is if you'd want to include some, and you know we get weird results here, a factor analysis would be another way of transforming the variables. I was actually going to talk about, you know, there are other ways, and the point is that if you transform the variables so that you reduce the colinearity, that factor analysis for two variables could well work. But then the problem with that is if you want to make causal inferences off of the effect of tenure. And the reason we went to this was that we were very interested in the tenure effect. And if we did a factor analysis, we wouldn't be able to make inferences about the tenure effect. And because the age effect was much smaller, we just dropped age. But, you know, there are other things that you can do. Just to give you an idea of the things you could do with birth weight, one of the things that is becoming more common in perinatal epidemiology is you include gestation as a continuous variable, and then within each week of gestation you do a z-score on the birth weight and include a dummy if the patient is above or below some extreme percentile. You can do a dummy for if they're extremely big or extremely small, or you can do a z-score on the birth weight distribution, and you can put that z-score in because that's where you line the distribution of birth weight within that gestational week. Again, it's a transformation that breaks the correlation. And that's what you want to think about. You may have to think about things creatively to address this underlying multicollinearity problem.
Okay.
And you know, in doing this, as in I note on the last line here, you can actually – you know, we actually improved the prediction, you know, the regression diagnostics about how well our model was predicting, because this was a logistic regression. Our area under the ROC curve went up. There were other questions, Wei?
Yeah, I think there's the other question is also, I think you probably explained that. They asked if you can put the different types of nurses into groups and then to do conduct analysis. And,
yeah.
Right. And
so
go ahead.
Just to reiterate, if you have collinearity, transforming the you can start playing with transformations of the variables, and that may fix the problem.
Okay. And there's also a question when you talk about the eigenvalues, right? And
yeah.
Can you explain the output for the eigenvectors again? I think the
those are just numbers that come out of the regression that I'm not going to go into the details of econometric. I think I will defer on that one.
Okay.
That's just that regression. It's a number for associated with that regression plane.
Okay, I think you can move forward.
Okay, well, I have actually covered everything I was doing. I was just saying, just putting a graph of the fact that the functions looked a little bit different, and that's one of the reasons that, you know, because males, females, and multiples have sort of different relationships, especially at smaller gestations, breaking them apart reduced some of and controlling for that in terms of their underlying risk is why our model prediction went up. That is all the material I have to cover. It's an old book, but there is a really good book that's referenced here on regression diagnostics. That's the one I have from graduate school. There may well be newer versions of something like this. And, there are lots of good textbooks out there, but we're supposed to put references up at the end. And in closing, I'll come back to any questions, is the next lecture's in 2 weeks where I'm going to talk about limited dependent variables. So essentially that's models to use when your dependent variable is what is called a limited dependent variable, which means it's like a 0-1 or it's a small count or other things like that, as opposed to a long continuous thing like income. And are there any other questions, Wei?
We answered almost all the questions, except a few I just answered here. I don't think we.
Okay, in that case,
we need to bring to the audience.
Okay, we have finished a few minutes early.
There's one question I probably just missed for some reason. Maybe we, you know, since we have time, you can try.
Okay.
Now, is it possible still about your, I think it's about the nurse staff example. The question asked is it possible to prove that an increase in experienced staff nurses increases ROI? I don't know what ROI is. You probably, do you know?
Return, but I'm guessing they're talking about return on investment. That's not really related to the econometrics, but I will note that what we used in this model was called a fixed effects model. This is sort of deviating from the topic of the lecture, which is repeated observations on the same unit. In this case, we had many years of monthly data, and your power, which when you estimate what economists call a fixed effects regression, you're powering the estimates off of the within unit variance. So you get, it's not quite causal, but it's close to, it's good enough that many people accept it for making causal inferences that increasing the unit tenure is actually associated with better outcomes. And to answer the person's question, we did a back of the envelope calculation that from the VA's perspective, the added cost of paying, you know, 1 year's higher salary of nurses was more than offset by the clinical savings in terms of reduced complications. So that would be a good investment for the VA to try to get, retain their, do more to retain their nurses.
Okay. I think the question at the end, there's still the complete question is that it's impossible to prove that a increase in experienced staff nurses increases ROI for the different hospital levels as well with those same data points.
I'm not sure what you're asking. So basically, that's, you know, you're asking a question about causal inference, and we can do what we can do. It's never going to be perfect. Sure, you know, you want to run, you know, you can run randomized trials, but those are expensive and take a long time. And so, you know, this is, you know, the idea of using observational data to make inferences, and we want to be able to use methods that allow us to make more causal inferences, and fixed effects is one of those.
Okay.
Again, not perfect.
I think that's about it.
Okay.
Maybe you want to close earlier.
All right. We'll go back to to tell people, although I finished, don't run away because you're going to be asked to fill out a survey.
Right. There's a very short survey asking how this seminar met your needs. So please do stick around just to fill that out. That is only for our use in cyber seminars so that we can continue to bring high quality sessions to you. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time and for presenting today. With that, if there are no other closing comments, I'll just again repeat, please do fill out that survey, and I hope everybody has a good day.